Good afternoon, good day, good morning to all of you out there. This is Eddie Huff, and you're listening to a special broadcast of Fresh Black Coffee featuring Idle Cure. Yes, I have with me guitarist and writer of Idle Cure, Mark Ambrose, this afternoon. We're sitting here in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, just chilling, having had a lot of fun here this week. And yeah, we're just enjoying each other's company. Old friends met in Idle Cure and some of the particularly the European stuff, as it is that's how I met them when I was a promoter overseas. So anyway, Mark, welcome. How are you doing?
Eddie, it's so good to be with you. It has been way too long.
Yes, way too long.
And as you said, old friends, we won't talk about how old, but we talk about the maturity of our friendship.
Yes,
exactly. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
But it's been good to rekindle with you these last few days.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how some people you just hit it off with, and it's like you become lifelong friends with these guys that you would never expect. I mean, you and I come from very different backgrounds, very different backgrounds, but nevertheless, we share one thing, of course, that's the Lord, and we're both tend to be humorous. We get subtle jokes and some not so subtle jokes, and Mark's the guy, he's always been able to point out my idiosyncrasies. For some of you that don't know, I tend to have, well, I used to have badly Tourette's.
And actually, here it goes.
I talked to a client, she was a psychiatrist, and I was telling her about the Tourette's, and she says, oh yeah, what you had today, we just call it a tic disorder.
Nice.
Full-blown Tourette's, I guess, is when you're cussing every 5 minutes and can't help it. I think some even reach out and slap or hit people. I think it can be that extreme. I think I told you, Mark, how at one point HBO had a special that was named I Have Tourette's, But Tourette's Doesn't Have Me. And that was kind of interesting. It really touched me because I saw these little kids that had Tourette's and it just took me back to when I had it. I've told you I barked and stuff like that.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, but moving on here, the whole real focus of this today is to go back into the Idle Cure days. Give me a little background on how Idle Cure got started.
Well, a little disclaimer here, going back. So I'll do my best to go back.
Yeah, unfortunately, we tried to get Steve Shannon, lead singer, who you had, because he's got the...
He remembers every detail of everything, and I swear I wasn't even there, but he says I was. So, I'll believe him. How did we get started? Gosh, it was back in the days where guys were doing different bands, and players were moving around from one band to another, and through the music world, I met Steve, and we hit it off kind of as a just, you know, songwriter. He's a singer, I'm a guitar player, and started working together, and then added another player and another player. But at the end of the day, the real core of it was me and Steve, and then ultimately ended up being Pete, who is a keyboard player. But again,
Pete Lamacken.
Yeah, Pete Lamacken, who was bouncing around from band to band. And that's really what the core of the group was. We used different drummers on different records. Clark Edmonds was probably the one we used the most, but he didn't play on every record. So it's primarily me, Pete, and Steve. Yeah.
How did you end up with Frontline? Frontline Records.
Yeah, I think they kind of ended up with. Let me think. It was local. It was a local alternative label in Southern California, and we had relationships with Jim Kempner and Bill Baumgart, who was doing a lot of producing for that label, and went in and did a demo at Bill's house, and he presented it to Jimmy. And, you know, back in those days, you signed contracts on napkins at Denny's, you know?
Yeah. That was the day. The day many rue today, you know?
Yeah, you regret it later.
Oh, man, that is too funny. But that is, it's amazing. I have to tell you, when I started in Christian music, it was back in the early 70s, actually. And I started booking bands for my church. in El Paso, Texas. And it was a pretty easy gig because there was nothing between Phoenix and Dallas in those days. Yep. You know, you just had all, so we would, people would just come because they needed a place to sleep and eat on the way. And oh my goodness, we had Sweet Comfort, Benny Hester Band, all of those early. But it's funny because there was a shift that occurred, I guess it was around 1979 or 80. Bands and artists started getting agents, I mean, professional agencies. And they started having these contracts with writers. And it's kind of, I remember Larry Norman and Randy Stonehill's manager calling me. Good guy. I mean, good guy. But, you know, they wanted this special stuff. And I really had a hard time with it. But then I found out that there were churches that would, they would say, hey, we've got Idle Cure here. And, oh, they just blessed us. Let's take an offering. Let's give them. Let's reach deep and give. Yep. And then they give the band $500 and pocket everything else. Yep. So there were two sides to that whole story. Did you ever run into that where you felt kind of like you were used? Or?
No, one time. Only one time. And I failed to mention that me and Steve and all that, that was all the mid 80s as far as timing goes.
Right.
You get into Larry Norman, you got to, you know, you're a decade earlier, basically. Yeah. But no, there was one time, and it was a concert up in Pacific Northwest, Seattle. And yeah, I made the fatal mistake of not getting a deposit down. I usually, what I usually did is when we'd go out and play a date, I would have them front the money for the airfares, and then we'd pay balances and figure it out later. So I knew they had skin in the game, right? If they're going to pay for airfares. But in this particular one, for whatever reason, needed a delay. Is it okay? I'll for sure pay you later, whatever. So we bought our own airfares, went up, did the concert, and never saw a nickel. So we lost on that one. But that was only one. So I'm grateful for that.
Praise God, I want to hit how we met. I have to tell you, it's funny. I was with Youth with a Mission, YWAM, and I worked with Karen Lafferty, one of the original Maranatha music artists from the mid-70s there. And we had an organization called Musicians for Missions, and I started booking concerts with certain artists that wanted to come over. They didn't want to eat bloodwurst, sleep in barns and things, so they knew that I would always take care of their comfort level, you know. And so I remember, I think Bob Farrell, Farrell and Farrell were the first ones to come over. Then we did the Garmin Key with Twyla Paris and Farrell and Farrell. And then I moved to Germany, and I used to get demos. We had a book distribution thing to Middle East, Europe, Middle East, and Africa, U.S. military. We would set up book tables and bookstores. And one day I got this album in the mail, and it was from this new band called Idle Cure. And I hit Breakaway, and it was like, oh my goodness, are you serious? And I'm sure that was the reaction everywhere, because Breakaway was so fresh, so different from even any Christian rock out there. It was just such a, I mean, still today, there's people that think Breakaway may have been one of the greatest Christian songs of all time. And it hit me that way. And then I listened to the whole album, and then I kept listening and kept listening. My wife would say, would you please stop playing that thing? Yeah, but it was so good, so fresh and everything. And just in general, Frontline was just they had great artists at that time. Yep. It was a really refreshing change to some of the stuff that was going on. And I don't even remember how, but I remember writing you. I think I wrote you or called you. I can't even remember how I reached out to you and you responded. Said, yeah, we'll come. And it was kind of interesting because I think you're kind of unsure a little bit yourself. Who's this guy over there in Youth with a Mission? But you had this desire to go to Europe. You've always had this desire. You love to travel.
And I've been there. I've been there before. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and those were the days when, you know, you had to, you know, stay up late and call because of the time change. There was no emails. There was none of that. Maybe a fax machine. And so trying to time that. But, yeah, we were open to whatever God would have for us. And, you know, we didn't depend on it to make a living, to support our homes, our families. We had day jobs. So we could be selective in what we wanted to do. And, Europe was a attractive option. What I loved about Europe was there was no Christian market there. It was just music. And so you had music and you played music and, you know, you put us in bars, you put us in halls that probably had more smoke in the air than you could even breathe. And, but we love that, you know, or a punk rock barge in Amsterdam or whatever. It wasn't all Christianized yet. And that was really attractive.
Yeah, I still, we've been talking about it this week, how the first time I met them, I was in Germany and I met them in Amsterdam because the first date we had booked was on this barge in Amsterdam with a YWAM barge dealing with drug addicts and all of the street people and everything. Like, and they'd pack out this barge on the river. It was the Rhine River that runs through Amsterdam there, and we're
it's freezing too.
It was in the middle of winter. I think it was December, actually.
I think you're right.
And it was. And I'll get to that in a minute. What reminds me of that it was in the middle of winter, and it was almost Christmas time, which is really odd now that I think about it. Why in the heck did I book you guys in the middle of winter? But we met there in Amsterdam, and I remember I came in on a train. And somebody from YWAM there had you guys in a van and picked me up at the train station. And I remember riding back to the Samaritan's Inn is where we stayed.
Okay.
And Steve was sitting there and he was nervous. So we had talked about this and he was kind of nervous about what I expected, you know, a preaching band. And one of his bands, the evangelists and so forth. And he was kind of nervous. But as it worked out, it was a perfect fit, a perfect match. And it was just a lot of fun, but that date on the barge, I don't even know how you fit. How did we even fit the gear in there? And you were standing up on like a riser or something, and this boat, you know, this boat had probably 500 people just jam packed in. It was rocking and the lighting, and you could barely see over everybody.
I remember jumping down off the stage and walking in the crowd. Half of them weren't even paying attention, you know. And I'm
and you're playing the guitar in the middle of these places.
I got something better to talk about, you know. And then I remember when it came time to getting paid, they passed a miniature toilet around where people put money into it.
It was a level offering.
That was next level.
Oh, man. Toilet, that was awesome. A toilet offering,
Yeah.
Hey, look out the window.
I know.
We've got a deer standing outside this window looking. You say, hey, can I get in on this? That is the weirdest thing I've ever done. An interview and there's a deer at the window looking in. That's wow.
Welcome to Montana.
Yeah. Anyway, so then we did that. And then one of the highlights I think was we went to Cologne, Germany. We got on the train and said, let's go to Cologne. You know, it's not far. It was a couple of hours. And we went to the dome, the big cathedral there. Yeah. And I have funny memories. One of them, we went into the dome, and I don't know if it was Steve, Pete, or Dave Jansen, the sound, but somebody started whistling because we wanted to hear the echo. Okay. And I don't know if you remember, they started whistling, you know, and it was echoing, and all of a sudden these guys pop out from nowhere, you know.
Hey. Security. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that in here. You know, you crazy Americans. But it was kind of interesting. And they had do you remember they had the bones of some crusaders buried there? Do you remember?
Yeah. I mean, all those kind of churches, do they have relics?
Yeah, they were relics.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So,
and I still remember that. But then the highlight of that, it was, like you said, freezing. Cold. And so we went out and they happened to have what they call it in Germany, they call it a Christkindlmarkt or a Christmas market.
Yep.
And we went out there into this Christmas market and we're freezing. We're walking through everything was right near the train station and they were selling bratwurst on the street and this stuff called glue wine.
Yes.
And glue is actually just glow wine. It's wine that makes you glow. And it's got cinnamon in it and fruit stuff and so.
And it's hot.
Yeah, and it's hot. Oh, yeah, they cook it in these pots. Yeah. And I remember we got these bratwurst, and we had a thing of glue wine.
It was the best. My mouth's watering now.
We were glowing. Yeah, we weren't cold any longer, you know, those hot brats.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember years later, I think Steve was still talking about the brats in Cologne, Germany.
It was lightly snowing. It was super.
The only bad thing about that, he lost his voice. He started losing his voice.
That was a constant.
Yeah.
Because he was always out in the snow. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we did, you guys did dates that few American Christian artists did, because I remember we did that. We did Paris. We went to Paris and you guys did a gig in Paris, and it was just some random little place in Paris and Belgium on the streets in Brussels. Of course, some military gigs in Germany, and of course, I guess probably the high point in one sense would be the Flevo Festival in Holland, one of the biggest Christian music festivals in Europe.
It was one of the biggest.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say it was a highlight, but it was the biggest. I really liked you put on that Zoe Festival.
Oh, yeah, Zoe. I forgot. Yeah. You guys actually played at the Zoe Festival. Yeah, that was my pride and joy. I just loved doing that. I mean, we had...
That was packed.
Yeah.
That was a zoo. I mean, people were just sardines in there.
Yeah.
And feeling it. Yeah, super fun.
Yeah, and some of that, when I think back, it's crazy, Mark, when I think back, you know, people who played that, nobody's ever heard of this, of course, but, you know, Larry Norman was there, the Imperials, Stryper, we had Stryper, DeGarmo and Key played it, you guys played it.
I want to say we played it the first year, or maybe the second
year. Yeah, it would have been the first year. It would have been the first one, because we actually changed the name at some point upon this rock festival. I think that was, Larry was there, and then we went back to Zoe for the final one before I came back to the States. But, yeah, we had some great times, but I do have to say this. Of all the groups, you guys were – we bonded the best because you guys were just pretty laid back. I mean, you were just the most – laid back, and also we did the train thing so much, and I remember, and I'm just going to share this, they had a sound man named Dave Jansen, and I found David wasn't a Christian, he wasn't a Christian at the time, and he and I ended up becoming roommates and kind of cabin mates, because the trains had those individual compartments, and you guys would be in one, and then Dave and I would be in another one, and I just got to share a lot with him, and he was sharing me about why he wasn't a Christian and why he didn't. But he was just the greatest guy. I mean, we bonded like I don't think anybody. I just loved that guy. And by the time we got in, we roomed together. How he told me all his stories, how he'd been in the Marines, and I was always worried, are we going to disturb his sleeping? He said, no, man, I could. I slept with like 40 guys, in a room, and after a while, you sleep through anything. But he was just a wonderful guy. And then I think shortly after you guys got back, he accepted the Lord, and it affected him. So that was always a very special time for me. Just the fact, not just that, the normal ministry, but even within your band, you were able to, your own family there, you're able to affect somebody.
Yeah, no, Dave is a good guy. And of course he's passed away now.
Yeah.
And, but he engineered, I want to say all five records. That we did.
He was good. I mean, he was so. Now, did you meet him through Bill?
Yeah.
He an engineer for Bill Baumgarten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we brought him with us just to kind of make sure, because he knew us in and out. And again, we were one of the first projects Bill had done with Frontline. So everything was organic. Everything was new. Everybody was trying new things that had never been done and exploring. And so, 10 years later, you're filling holes now, the things that have been done, and can you do it better and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So the very green time for everybody.
But man, it was such a great time. And I think that's what made it so good.
Yep.
You know, the fact that it was so new and fresh and in a sense, innocent.
Yep.
You know, the innocence of it. Oh, you know, I do remember this. You guys did a festival. I can't remember where it was, in Minnesota. I think it was Minnesota. And Dave was there, and I think, as I recall, something happened with Whiteheart sound guy.
Okay.
And they ended up asking Dave to run sound for them. And then in Germany at the Zoe Festival, I think Dave ended up running sound for all kinds of people. Rick Hua and Margaret Becker, I think Rick couldn't get a guitar player. And so he had brought Margaret Becker as his guitar player. Now, it wasn't a Margaret band. Nobody even knew that. Who's this chick up on the stage with Rick Hua band?
Right.
And it's Margaret Becker, and she was the lead guitarist, and she was just jamming on the guitar for Rick Hua. But yeah, those were some great times. Those were some great times. Hey, I want to move forward a little bit. So you came back at that time. Part of the time when I first met you, I think you had either just graduated or you were still studying at USC. You were in finance.
I was done.
You were done. You had just finished, and you went to work for Arthur Anderson and then Pete Marwick.
Yep.
And
good memory. Look at you.
Oh, hey, listen.
No notes in front of you either. Look at you.
There's certain things that are just imprinted.
Freestyle,
yeah. And I used to enjoy coming to your house. I mean, I had some of the greatest times. You put me in the little servant's quarters back there, you know, remind me of my slavery ancestry, and all of that.
By the way, I've always called you my brother from another mother. And it was a pleasure to meet your mother recently. She's 94 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. What a cool thing.
Yeah. She's a piece of work. She's something. 94. Oh, took 94 years to get that lady like
She had to raise you.
Yeah.
She is a piece of work.
I remember, we had some great times. And it's funny, people out there listening, the stuff that would, I remember the accidental stuff. You were grilling a tri-tip or something, and all of a sudden John Elefante shows up, you know, comes over. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just coming to visit because you and him had known each other.
Yep.
And then together. One time I remember you went up to studio up in L.A. or somewhere in Orange County there, and Petra was recording the Petra Praise, the first Petra Praise album, and I'm sitting out front, and Dino, of course, was producing Dino Elefante was producing that Petra Praise, and so all of a sudden they came out, and Eddie, hey, come in here, and it was you and me, and along with the Petra guys, and we were doing the chorus verses on these praise songs that they were doing, you know, they were doubling, you know,
right.
And there were, I think there were about eight of us in there. Dino was singing and John was probably with them. And we were all singing these praise songs. So it's funny, the accidental or coincidental things that were happening.
Yes.
And I would come visit you there in California. It was a good time. I was still living in Germany at the time. But let me just throw this in, this is
how it goes during that time. I remember you bring up Breakaway, which kind of became our anthem. That song really struggled in the studio when we recorded it, and we were singing the chorus at the time. We just said, it's not working. And so I literally had 24 hours to go home and rework the chorus and bring it back because we were wrapping the record up, but this Breakaway was just dangling. And so the chorus you hear now was not the original chorus of the song. It was literally an emergency rewrite to figure it out. And then it became the anthem. You know what I mean? So those are the kind of random things. Like I said, you don't expect things to happen that do. You just kind of do your best.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I remember Breakaway was a great song, great first song, you know, just a boom in your face, right? But as I recall, I think my favorite song on that first album was Feeling the Heat.
Okay.
For some reason, I just enjoyed the energy of that song. And then watching you do it live, I think, helped too because it was a really, really great song to do. But then your second album, though, was after you came over.
Okay.
You guys went home.
Yep.
And then So Many Faces was the big hit of
Tough Love record, right?
Yeah, Tough Love, exactly. Yeah. Tough Love's your second album. And I think, as I remember you saying, that your trip to Amsterdam and through your Paris and Belgium and everything, seeing that, working with YWAM in there, it really inspired that song.
Yes. Well, it, the only places we ever toured as a band was Europe. All the rest were fly dates. And what I mean by that, you fly in, you play a concert, and you leave. But we never did the tour bus, you know, driving from one date to another, from one state to another. And so that's why a lot of Idle Cure fans never got the opportunity to see us, or you'll hear them, you know, on Facebook pages, never saw those guys or whatever, because our time was limited because we had day jobs and we could only be gone for so long. And so Europe, you brought us there and we'd come for 2 weeks, but in the 2 weeks you'd have us playing every night. And so we couldn't really do that in the States because, you know, you got 2 days of travel between each date and that kind of thing. So we did a lot of fly dates. So anyway, that's why we became, quote, a tour band of Europe.
Ah, okay. I know the guys in Germany, Christmas Rock Night,
there
in German, I remember they were calling you the house band. Idle Cures are a house band, you know, right, because they just loved you. I mean, that was.
Well, the Germans were great. Yeah. I mean, go, man.
Yeah, they had some great time. And, you know, again, that reminds me of just how easygoing. I mean, man, I remember one time we came into Christian Artists. It was in August, and got there like at 1 a.m. in the middle of the night, and they threw us in some rooms with bunk beds and everything. Yep. Everybody was so tired, they just threw their stuff in and crashed and went to sleep. And I think you guys actually, no, it was a tour. You had your wives with you even, I think.
Maybe. On that one. Was that pouring rain that night? No.
I think it was. Yeah, okay. I think it was. I remember that one. And then that other, I think it was a Christian rock night or a different one, but you guys were the last ones on. I think everybody got to bed at like 4 or 5 a.m. It was like, and I finally said, I'll see you guys. And I went back to sleep and I woke up and you guys were coming in and I said, dudes, man, you know, but that's one of the things I think that made you guys so special. And most of the groups that I toured with or that we had come over, had that attitude. I remember the DC, we did a DC Talk, Margaret Becker tour, and there was somebody, Whiteheart. DC Talk, no, I'm sorry, it was DC Talk and Whiteheart. And just great guys, too. They were good guys. Yep, it wasn't still, there wasn't the level of bonding that you guys and I had, but it was just, they were good guys, too. Hey, listen, we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to take a break to So Many Faces. Yeah, still one of my favorites, So Many Faces, Idle Cure. I'm here with Mark Ambrose, guitarist of Isle Cure and songwriter. And I think Mark was telling me he thinks that actually that was written by Steve Shannon.
I think the lyrics are. Yeah, this is the gentler, milder side of
Isle Cure, which I usually
didn't do.
Yeah, oh, that's why. Okay, that's it. If it was Pete Lamacken, Pete, please forgive us. Hey, we love you, man. And maybe it was you. For some reason, I'm thinking it was Pete Lamacken that wrote that one.
Check the credits.
Yeah, we don't have any here with us, unfortunately. But so anyway. Mark, yeah, you went through the accounting phase. You became an accountant with Arthur Anderson.
Correction.
Oh.
I was a finance guy, not an accountant.
Finance guy. Okay.
Yeah, we used to say, you know, we
make. Is there a difference?
Yes. We used to say finance guys make the money, accountants count it.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. I like that. As Donkey would say, yeah, I like that. I like that.
Shrek. It's an old business school joke.
Yeah. So, well, no, either way, you worked for those two accounting firms.
There you go.
So that maybe that's why I thought you were an accountant since you worked in accounting.
Makes sense.
But somehow, so tell me, by the way, for those of you who don't know, Mark is now pastoring Pacific Coast Church in San Clemente, California. So tell us, how did you get from being a finance guy for these big six accounting firms to being a pastor?
Back up. I was first a musician and playing music and doing that. Even we have bands before Isle Cure with Steve as well. And then it was like, okay, I got married. Now I got to get, quote, responsible. So I went back to school. And so became the finance, went into the appraisal valuation world of public accounting. And so Isle Cure was always a parallel track, made my living through the appraisal valuation world, but did ministry through Isle Cure. And so balancing those two. Then when Isle Cure started slowing down, and this would have been early 90s, 93, had the opportunity to step into local church ministry. And so as we slowed down our going on the road, the fly dates, the recordings, I could dig into a little more ministry. Again, parallel tracking, still working the day job, but then now replacing Isle Cure with local pastoral ministry. Then that started growing. Long story short, I ended up doing it full-time and leaving, quote, my day job. And so, yeah, I've been in the ministry now in the pastorate for 26 years.
Wow, 26 years.
Yeah.
Does that mean I'm old?
Wow.
I can't even believe that. 26 years already you've been out there. Gee.
Yep.
So I do have to say, if you're going to be a pastor, you picked a really nice spot.
The church is
on a hill overlooking the Pacific and all that. You know, it's crazy. But
it was a calling.
If only we could all get a calling like that. No, seriously, though. No, it is amazing, though, that to come from where you came from and I assume you got saved through Calvary Chapel, Chuck Smith, and all of the
Jesus
back
end movement.
The Jesus movement, as I did. Mine was in Texas, Jesus Chapel, which was an offshoot of Calvary Chapel. I mean, when you think of all of the lives that Chuck and Calvary touched throughout the world, I mean, it really is amazing. And the music, how they revolutionized music with Maranatha music and everything, it's quite something. And so now in pastoring, what is your burning? I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot and maybe kind of pressure, but is there an over?
No comment.
Is there an overarching burden you have and something you really want to say to the world today, particularly the body of Christ? If you could, what would you? Because honestly, we're in a mess. You may see it differently. I think that the church today and America and Europe, the world right now is in a mess. In fact, you know, when I got saved in 73, and Chuck Smith at that year took a group to Israel. And I remember Chuck was writing home and calling back, you know, said if Jesus doesn't come tonight, it'll be tomorrow. I mean, that expectation of a rapture was that imminent. Remember the Yom Kippur War or the Six-Day War. One of the two wars took place that summer in that period of time. There was all kinds of stuff going on. But anyway, because at least how I feel things are in the situation in the world today, what do you think, how do you see everything?
How do I see everything? Well, okay, you know, glad you you know, nutted that down to a specific yes or no question. So, yeah, I personally believe that there's a lot of fear going on today, and there's a lot of concern, a lot of disruption, a lot of division, a lot of arguments, a lot of conflict, a lot of anger. And that's nothing new. It's been going on for millennia. I mean, talk about the setting with Jesus and Rome and the drama there and the hate and the racism that was even going on between Israel and their neighbors, right? And they wouldn't even step on their property, and they had different dietary laws. And Paul was fighting that in the early church. He's Book of Colossians, Book of Ephesians, you know, there is no difference between Greek or Jew or, you know, barbarian or woman or what. He's dealing with division. He's dealing with people that are having now to come together as Christians, but they were raised with different worldviews, different cultures, different rights and wrongs, and now they're having to get along with each other. And even today, I mean, right, we got a divided world. It's bad out there. It's what team you're on. You're on the wrong team, you're on the right team. But roll the clock back, man. In the 60s, you had the Vietnam War. You had the hippie movement. You make love, not war. You had the older generation, the new generation. You had a president that was assassinated, you know, and then go into the 70s, and then you had the Nixon era, and then you had, yet Christianity can still flourish. And so in my mind, Christianity can and does flourish when there's conflict, when, as you say, we're in a mess. That's what the gospel's all about. Not to get in the mess, to correct the mess, to make the mess clean because it's dirty. Jesus never did that. It's to point to a place of hope that our home is not here. Our roots are not here. We're temporary, and we're to be that light on the hill. And not shoveled under a bushel, but that light on a hill that shines bright, that the people, when they see how we treat each other in the midst of conflict, they will glorify our Father in heaven. And so the whole roll of the eyes, oh my goodness, this place. Okay, true, 100%. Now what does God want us to do? How does he want us to act? Well, I disagree. Well, how does God want us to disagree? To label right off and avoid and call them names? Or to be able to bridge in and talk. So this is, I think, a real opportunity for Christians to grow and not just be comfortable and bring back the old days when I didn't have to do anything and everything was Christianized. You know, it's kind of the punk rock barge, really. It's like, okay, it's crazy, it's nuts, it's out of control. Everybody's got different perspectives, ideas. Some listen, some don't. Now how do we be? Versus, you know what, sink the barge and create a ship where I can just walk around and get along with everybody. It's like, nah, you know.
That's good. That's good.
Anyway, I ranted there.
No. It's good. This is what we need. I know, because I'm troubled. I vacillate between kind of, you know, oh, just pray, and then the next time calling fire down. You know.
It's emotional.
It is. You know, I want to take the Elijah approach, you know, and just, you know, burn all the false prophets, right. You know, in their fake sacrifice and the water too, you know, but at the same time, there's that part of me that keeps praying and wanting. And the good thing though, and I think what you're saying in at the core of what you believe in, there's always hope. You know, it's interesting because when I got saved, Mark, I got into the whole, well, we went to these meetings where it was a lot of word of faith, mm-hmm. you know, name it, claim it, mm-hmm. prosperity type stuff, and just if you believe strong enough, and it just never worked. I was praying for my allergies to go away and this and that, and prayed for this one girlfriend, and which God didn't give me, and thank goodness in the end, you know, but something God showed me, many years later. I mean, this is probably maybe 15, 20 years ago, because I've had some medical issues. I had the back issue that we've talked about, the back issue, and then I had blood clots and everything. And I remember there's the thing of, well, am I supposed to, I'm not really sick, you know, I'm well. God's healed. I'm healed. You know, say it long enough and it happens. But in the aspect of faith that you have to continue to positively confess versus you can't let any negativity, you know, that whole thing. And I remember all of a sudden it was like God revealed faith is not a weight. It's like that became a weight. You know, I constantly had to try to push this, push the oppression away, make my faith. And it was like lifting the boat, like Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the hill. Mm-hmm. And then God showed me faith is not a weight, it's a cork. You can't hold it down. So I had this diverticulitis, and I don't know if you've ever heard of it or know, and get these holes in your intestines, basically. And it felt like, honestly, somebody was stabbing me with like a 10-inch knife rapidly across my stomach over and over. I'm sitting there crying out, writhing, and God. And it just went away. But all of a sudden, I could not be in despair. I just kept feeling, God's going to get you through this. God's going to get you through this, God. And it was like, I wanted to doubt. I wanted not to believe. But like that cork, it pops, my faith pops back up, that everything tells me, oh man, you're done for, your stomach, it's going to, you know, it's cancer, it's this. But for some reason, I always kept having hope. The back thing, you know, you're supposed to have a spinal fusion, and I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, but God, please deliver me. So whatever you say, I'm okay. But this, I just kept getting this hope, this faith thing in me that wouldn't let me stay down. You know, I want to be bummed. And I know I've taken a long way around this, but that's kind of, I think what you're saying and what I have within me, although I want to call fire down on certain people in government and even in the church in different areas of this and this and this. But within me, I just have this faith that it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. God's still there. He hasn't given up. He hears, he knows, you know, and in his time, he's going to take care of it. And I think that's the important thing, that we don't lose hope or faith. It's actually the fear.
Yeah.
I was thinking of, was it Franklin Roosevelt? We have nothing to fear but fear itself, right? That's the, even COVID, you know, there's so much fear around this whole COVID thing. And it's almost like it's being forced upon us, you know, the news continually, everything you read, you know, oh, there's a new variant, there's a new this, this didn't work, you got to have two, now you got to have three, and the people that aren't, you're going to die, you're going to infect, you know, and it's just, you have two types of people, people that are totally riddled with fear, and then you have those other ones that just are kind of dumb, you know, they just don't want to do anything out of rebellion, not necessarily using their head. And I don't think either one of those is right. And I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Sure. I think it's what you're saying.
No, it is. You don't agree? No. Yeah, no. I
think everybody should take a media fast. You know, try not watching a news channel for a month and see how you're doing.
But see, I keep hearing about that. But to me, that's burying your talent in the ground.
I understand it can be viewed as avoidance. But in reality, I think there's such an obsession of daily consumption of it that there's an imbalance there that's not healthy. You know, think about how you used to watch the news 30 years ago. You weren't glued to it. You didn't watch hours and hours of commentary. You didn't, you know. It's addictive almost. Like I said, go like a month without doing it, and I bet you'll be better off. I bet you'll be healthier, because a lot of what we fear is not even reality. It's ideas. It's commentators and editors trying to create drama and then solve the drama and sell ads. And, you know, it's if everybody could take a deep breath, because it's like a constant high school, your team is terrible, our team is the best. And you see it. You see it vicarious attachments, like the guys that go to the football games. They have a couple beers down, and before you know it, they're punching each other out about whose team is better. Neither one of them can play football. They've never been on a gridiron. They're probably out of shape, and the team doesn't even know who they are, yet they're willing to go to blows over it. Why? Because of this vicarious attachment. It's the soccer mom that goes too far. When her kid scores a goal, she scores a goal. And so that's going on today all day long. Are you a Fox News? Are you CNN? Are you OAN? Are you one of them? Are you one of them? And then, you know, they hate each other. And how does a Christian navigate through that? See, that's where we get back to, well, I know that we shouldn't have anger. I know we shouldn't have malice. I know we shouldn't, you know, be gossiping. I know we shouldn't be critical. The fruit of the Spirit is joy, peace, patience, kindness, self-control. Whoa. Is that going on today in the church? Peace, patience, kindness, self-control, the fruit of the Spirit?
So you're saying calling down fire on these people is not just necessarily saying, the way.
Turn the TV down, man. That's why I come out here to Montana.
Just to get refreshed and rebuilt 100%. To go back. And, No, I understand. As I said, it's a constant thing for me going back and forth. To really get a hold. And the only thing that does keep me going is the faith to know that in the end, God is in control.
Yep.
Regardless of what
and I... And just the whole, you know, emotionally healthy spirituality. I love Peter Sicarzio's stuff. And you know, he did a lot of research going back to the church fathers, the desert dwellers, and their practice of silence and to be quiet and still before the Lord. It is hard, and part of his little devotional is you're quiet for 2 minutes, and you just turn everything off, you know. And in 2 minutes, my goodness, when you try to be quiet for 5 minutes, you'll see it feels like 3 hours. And number two, you see your mind racing everywhere, you know. And to get to that place where you can be still before the Lord, is that an idea, or are we really doing it? You know what I'm saying? So that's all I'm really passionate about is. I get it. I get the fear. I get the. I have heavy political views, so I'm not this apolitical person. But my role is a pastor, not a politician. I'm to point people to Jesus, and that's what God's Word calls me to do. So, okay, all that's there, 100%. Now what? Well, you can go political. That's cool. But now what? Are you having peace, patience, kindness, self-control? You know. Are we bridging gaps? Or are we creating more gaps? Because how are we going to reach people if they're on the other side of the division table? So it's a real challenge, but I think it's an opportunity to grow. That's not avoid, not dodge, not duck, not hide, but to grow.
Well, that's very good. Seriously, I'm not just saying that. It really is. And I think I need that because I do get in just so intensely into it. I speak it. Different groups, and they ask me to come, and I have a totally different, I believe I have a different role, a different gifting in a sense, because, 100%. You know, with my background being black and 100%. White, and I go between black worlds and white worlds, and, that, and, you know, I've been there and seen this and that type of thing. So it's a little different thing than where you would come from.
It's a different role and responsibility.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I do hear, and I need that every so often to just be brought back to the quiet.
It's the illustration I give sometimes. If we're not careful as Christians, we create this island and we raise our kids on this island and we have our ways, our island ways. And then our kids grow up and leave the island and they go across the bay and they're on the mainland and they're exposed to things. And rather than say, hey, come on back. You know, we shoot gospel bullets at them when they approach the island because they believe something different or they've been exposed to something different or they're wrestling with something different. And rather than say, come on back, let's talk. It's like the Amish community. You know, I realized that, wow, a toaster actually works. Nope, keep your toasters, stay away from us. That's what we got to be careful of because we're going to end up being like all the other dying agencies, like an Elks Lodge or a Moose Lodge. It's an era. It's a time frame but it's going to go out of date because we've been unable to reach across the table and actually listen, be patient, ask questions. No, we label, we write off. That's easy. That's lazy.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. Going full circle, coming back to our original area of music.
Yes.
Where do you see the music, Christian music scene in particular? Do you think, or what role do you think, we've got about 10 minutes here, 5 or 10, but what role do you see Christian music playing in the world today?
Oh, that's a good question. And I don't probably want to shoot from the hip on that one. I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. I know what it was in the 80s. I know what it was in the 90s.
Do you still listen to much
Christian music? The fact that I'm stalling means not so much.
Yeah. You know, I will say I rarely listen to CCM anymore. The only thing I really listen to is worship. I mean, the Christian. Right. To me, the best music, not just Christian music today, is these worship groups from, I mean, and they're everywhere. You know, I mean, from all over the country, all over the world. Every time I think, you know, oh, Elevation Church, and then you got, what's their name out of Nashville? I can't even remember their name. But, and then in Denver, they've got them. And, of course, Australia, you know, our Aussie friends. I mean, just awesome. We wake up every morning to breakfast. My wife, we have one, a little Alexa, the Echo, Amazon. And we say, Alexa, play praise music, you know, man, and just, and she knows what we like, which is kind of a scary thing.
Yeah.
But I just can't get enough. I mean, in the morning and then going to bed at night, I just love listening to the worship because how they can still come up with, you know, you wonder, how can you still keep coming up with fresh stuff, you know, to sing about your relationship with the Lord and in worship in particular, praise and worship stuff. But it's fresh. It's clean. So much of it is pure. I mean, I don't know about the lives of the people, but man, it is some, I don't think anybody could listen to that very long and not just be affected spiritually.
Yeah. And in my 26 years of ministry or whatever, I was a worship leader for 5.5 years because I was the only guy that played guitar in the church at the time. I was looking for a worship leader. So I was a fill-in for 5.5 years. And God showed me a lot in that, because I had always viewed worship as kind of the warm-up. You know, they come in the auditorium, music hasn't stopped yet, and, you know, the message is coming, which is, you know, the meat and potatoes. And I found that I met God in some most profound ways during the worship time than the message time. And so I do respect that. And now, I think my latest thing is I've been doing a lot of country.
Really? I was going to ask you, country?
Not playing, just listening.
Yeah. Oh, listening. Yeah. There does seem to be a more down-to-earth, I mean,
yes,
the real.
100%.
You know, that's the
it's
thing.
It's a story.
That, yeah, exactly. Do you think you see an Isle Cure reunion or anything like that?
You know how many times that's been
I'm sure.
Broached and dodged.
That would be interesting.
Let's just say the band never broke up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we never did. I just had gone through, I was managing the band at the time. And we had an agent out of Nashville, and we had to just back off the dates, like I told you. And I went into full-time ministry, and I told the guys, I said, hey, if you want to keep the thing going and manage it, I'll show up. But I can't front and load this anymore. And no one really stepped up. And so technically, we're still together. Have we written any new music? Nope. Will we? I don't know. We've talked about a GoFundMe page. We've talked about a bunch of different things.
You should have a lot of material. I know that after 26 years now in ministry and stuff, you should have some material.
I think the reality is most people wouldn't come, you know, it's like, you know, it's, could you really even put a tour together that works? I know White Hart tried. I know Petra tried. And, I highlight they tried.
Yeah, that's true.
It wasn't successful, and there was a lot of money lost, and they even combined forces, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's sometimes what makes it hard. You know, the nostalgia, you just have to just treasure what we had, right?
Yeah.
And let the rest go and pray for a new new era of music, maybe a whole new genre.
100%.
So,
a baton.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I know it's hard, you know, even for me. But more and more, I'm able to accept that, you know, it's time for a new.
No, I know it's hard.
Yeah.
The older you get, the more you know, yeah. It's like next gen stuff, yeah. Succession.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all that world.
And I think our role now is more or less to find and promote, if you will, and counsel or help.
Encourage, yeah.
Encourage that next generation of point them in the right way and see that they get there. Well, anyway, hey, Mark, thank you. Man, this has been fun. This is very different from what I normally do, probably from what you normally do as well.
No, it's always good.
It's pretty laid back. We're sitting here in easy chairs looking out on the beautiful Montana sky and mountain range and deer looking in the window here and little gophers running around. So I'll be headed back to my little southwestern Oklahoma, you know, views and
environment. Great to have you here the whole week too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's on so fast. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing too, how quickly this is all passed. But anyway, listen, when you talk to Pete, talk to Steve and their wives, and just, you know, God bless them. God bless you guys. And just, man, I treasure those times and those things that we were able to accomplish in Europe.
Yep.
And I know how many people would always just talk about you and so much of the. It's funny because Christianity in Europe is even a whole nother level of difficult from where we are at.
Yes.
And you guys, along with so many, you know, White Hart, Petra, all of the groups that came over there, were just that little glimmer of hope. It was like an oasis. And I don't know where it's at now. I haven't followed what they're doing or what's going on over there, but musically at least.
Yes.
But I know the people I talk to, they're kind of hurting spiritually, so please pray for them. And you out there listening, please pray for your brothers and sisters in Europe, because if you think we've got issues here, they're even that much worse over there. The apathy and just the deadness of the church over there is really sad. So, Mark Ambrose, thank you so much. God bless, brother.
Thanks for having me, Eddie.
Amen.